Please be seated. Court is ready to hear argument in 050261 Mid-Continent Insurance Company versus Liberty Mutual Insurance Company.
May it please the court, Mr. Brian Blake will present argument to the appellant. Appellant has reserved 5 minutes.
May it please the court, counsel. The reason we are here is because the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals has recognized that the San Antonio Court of Appeals holding in general agents is res nova as far as Texas insurance law is concerned. So the task before this court is to decide what to do with general agents effectively. The choices are, first, to reject it as a statement of Texas law. Alternatively, the court can accept it as Texas law and, in effect, manufacture a basis for it after the fact, because that basis does not exist in current Texas law.
Rather than start with that as a basis, what do you think about the fact that fixed rubbers and employers' casualty, as decided 1943 and 1969 respectively, were not mentioned in canal insurance? How do you interpret that?
I interpret that in canal, the court expressly declined the opportunity to create an independent cause of action between insurance carriers. And they said, we're going to restrict the cause of action to subrogation.
So an independent, direct cause of action is what they refuse, what we refuse to recognize in that case.
Correct.
Not a cause of action at all, just a direct action.
Correct. And whether it was Hicks and employers talks about is that in this context there cannot be a contribution action. Now, whether in canal the parties argued that there should be a contribution action is unclear. I think under the common law as applied to most jurisdictions, that a primary excess situation would never be the situation for a contribution action in any way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in canal insurance, we said that we're not going to recognize a direct action between insurers in this situation at this time.
Correct.
However, didn't employers casually say, in essence, that there's not a direct action in Texas? And didn't Hicks stand for that proposition as well? So isn't it puzzling to you that canal insurance says we're not going to recognize such an action at this time if two prior of our cases indicated that there's not one in Texas? That's really what I'm asking.
No, Your Honor, because in Hicks and employers, they did not absolutely preclude the existence of contribution action. But what the court said in those cases is that a contribution action is not viable in this context for two reasons. First, because of the voluntary payment. The parties settled the case. They were not under a legal compulsion to pay, so contribution is not applicable. Second, the parties have a pro rata insurance clause or other insurance clause that makes their liability several and independent. When those clauses are present, we're not going to allow contribution. Actually, employers implies that a contribution action could be viable in the right situation. If that several and independent clause is not present and if there has been no settlement. So it doesn't absolutely preclude a contribution action. Now, another distinction that is important to bear between the American Centennial scenario and the employer scenario is that in employers, they were dealing with two primary insurance companies. And that's where the issue of contribution comes up, because those insurance companies presumably insure the mutual risks. And that's a key fact. In a primary excess situation, you don't have a mutuality of obligation. The excess carrier's obligation does not kick in until the primary has fulfilled. So that is not a contribution scenario. So it's a little bit of apples and oranges. So
it sounds like you would suggest that canal insurance is really consistent with Hicks and employer.
Yes, I would.
All three cases just declined to recognize a direct action under those circumstances.
Yes. I see no inconsistency in Texas law on this issue whatsoever as long as you take general agents out of the mix. It's general agents that creates the confusion and the problem. And general agents announces what it calls a subrogation action between primary insurance carriers. But as the Fifth Circuit noted, it provides no basis for that. As we all know, subrogation is a derivative action. The company has to stand in the shoes of the insurer. General agents gives the carrier a brand new pair of shoes that the insurer does not have. And if you really read the case, it is really decided on principles of equitable contribution. It's talking about the rights of co-equal insurers and how they should each have rights vis-a-vis each other. That's not really subrogation. That's what the court calls it. But that's not what it is. It's really contribution. So what we are left with is three choices. You can just throw general agents out of the mix altogether, first. Second, you can expand the rights of insurers so that an insured would have a cause of action in this context. And then the insurance company could step into those shoes and maintain a traditional subrogation action. The third choice would be to say there's no need to go to that extreme. If we're concerned about rights and duties between insurance companies, we ought to do it head-on and create a cause of action for contribution. Those are the three choices. The second two, which involve changing Texas law dramatically, both require overruling significant Supreme Court precedent. They both raise the specter of unintended consequences, and so they both require really the utmost consideration of the necessity for the change.
Is what's at stake here in this dispute really about contract interpretation, or is it about some other common law issue? In other words, both insurers had policies or contracts with the insured. Both policies had pro rata clauses. Those contracts and the clauses govern the respective insurer's relationship with the insured.
Correct.
Neither insurance company, I can tell, had a contract with each other.
Correct.
Why do the contract clauses dictate, or how are they material to, whether the insurance companies have a cause of action against each other? So is this about the contract, since it's a fight between two insurance companies in this situation, or is this about some other area of the common law, like recognizing, or as you put it, expanding subrogation rights?
It can be either, depending on the approach that the court desires to take. The two insurance companies have no contract between each other. My client did not make any contract with the other insurance company.
Right.
The other insurance company, Liberty in this case, nevertheless wants to pick my client's pocket, wants to get into my client's pocket and take their money. There are two potential ways they can do that. They can do it through subrogation by asserting a right that the insured would have. If they do that, then they are bound by the contract. There's a problem with that because we have contractual defenses that preclude them from settling without our written consent. An insured could not walk out and settle a bad case and say, why'd you settle it? Well, it was really bad, so you pay up. An insured absolutely cannot do that under Texas law. What General Agents is saying and that Liberty Mutual is saying is that, well, an insurance company really can do that. We're just going to forget about those contractual defenses. So if you do that, you're outside the realm of contract and you're outside the realm of subrogation. And in that situation, you are, in effect, creating a new cause of action, a direct cause of action. You don't have to call it contribution. You can call it anything you want. Other jurisdictions do refer to it as contribution and build upon the common law doctrine of contribution. If it's not contribution, it's then there really isn't any common law basis for it.
Does it matter that the policies had other insurance clauses?
It matters, yes, because that is one of the factors under employers which precludes a contribution action. That was the basis for employers. employers versus transport insurance. That case said that if you have several and independent obligations, then you don't have any mutuality of obligation. A fundamental prerequisite of contribution is that the parties owe the same loss. They're responsible for the same harm, like when you have a joint tortfeasor situation. And the Supreme Court reasoned that, well, if you have these other insurance clauses that separate out liability, you don't really have that. So we're not going to allow a contribution action. So if you're going to go forward with the contribution action, you have to overrule employers on that aspect. Of course, another aspect of employers was that you can't go forward in this context because the insurance company has voluntarily settled. And that aspect would also have to be overruled if you're going to create a contribution action.
And if we're not going to create a contribution action, haven't they settled on at their own peril?
Yes, and that's the way the law always was before general agents in Texas, is if you think it's worth more, you pay, and good luck to you. We're going to stand and fight. It's up to us. It's completely analogous to the joint tortfeasor situation. Prior to Bonniewell Beach Aircraft versus Jenkins, it was common practice for one co-defendant to settle a case and then say, well, I paid, but it was really your fault. I'm suing you. I want the money back from you because you didn't pay. In Beach versus Jenkins, the court said, we're not going to do that anymore. If you settle and pay money, you're paying to release only your portion of the liability. Later, that was codified into the contribution scheme. And it's essentially the same thing here, or at least that's what we're asking for the law to remain, which is that if one carrier wants to go pay more, then let them. That's not a reason for them to pick our pocket, take money from us.
Does recognizing some sort of direct action or expanded subrogation action encourage settlement?
That is...
Rather than having you folks up here arguing in front of us?
That is an excellent point, and there is not much evidence on that, one way or the other.
If there's certainty in that the parties know that in the situation like the one we have today, that if a reasonable settlement amount is offered and then paid, and then the insurance companies with a common interest, that is both primaries, are going to be responsible in proportion to the amount of insurance they've provided, that provides some certainty. And when there's certainty, parties can act reasonably, can't they? When there's uncertainty, then you have more disputes, don't you?
I believe the empirical evidence is otherwise.
But there's certainty here in that if you settle at your own peril. So that seems to me that would encourage dialogue between the two respective primary insurers.
That is, in effect, what has happened over the years in Texas. You don't have a lot of these cases in Texas. You don't have a lot of people trying to bring these actions. And, in fact, since General Agents was decided 5 years ago, this case is the only one that has cited it or relied on it. In contrast, look at California and Illinois. They recognize an equitable contribution action similar to general agents. They have literally dozens of these cases. If you build it, they will come. If you allow this cause of action, you will have insurance companies arguing these issues, and you will have more of us here than you have now.
If we don't allow it, then who gets hurt? The insured?
The insured never gets hurt in this situation.
Why not?
Because if the insured was hurt, it would be a Stowers-type claim. It would be out of this realm.
So if we don't do something that encourages settlement, insured doesn't get hurt because the insured buys a lawsuit. The insured is not hurt because the insured has the right to a lawsuit. That's why the insured's not hurt?
In the sole context we're talking about here, first of all, in order to even get to the context that we're at in this case, you need two carriers, both of whom have assumed coverage without reservation. So there's never an issue that the insured is going to be out of pocket anything. Second element that you need before you get here is that the case be settled, because we're talking about a reasonable settlement value. So you never get here in a case like this if there's any harm to the insured. If there is any harm to the insured can bring an action. The insurance rights are governed by the Stowers Doctrine. Whether that's good enough or bad enough, that's something that's at issue in a Stowers case. And there are plenty of arguments to be made that there need to be changes in that doctrine. But that's not really what we're here about today. We're here about rights between insurance companies. I think the practical matter is one reason that you don't have amicus briefs in this case. I'm sorry, my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Blakely. The court is ready to hear argument from the appellee.
May it please the court, Mr. Richard Capshaw with an argument for the appellee.
Please the court, Your Honor. It is our position that we don't need to rewrite Texas law on insurance because of this case. As Mid-Continent has already told you all, this case presents a relatively narrow type of an issue, a relatively narrow occasion. You almost have to have a perfect storm for this case to arise. The only reason this case arose the way it did is because there was money available to pay the shortfall that Mid-Continent was refused to pay. Had that money not been available, the case could not have been settled. If the case was not settled, then the insured could have been harmed. He could have been harmed by an adverse judgment. He certainly would have been harmed by that need to bring a lawsuit if there was an excess judgment, and he would be harmed by the need to participate in this continuing litigation.
Those are all hypotheticals. I mean, to the extent that you're both primary on the policy, your obligation belongs to each of you. The insured's not harmed. The insured still has excess coverage in your instance, so there's no harm to the insured in that scenario.
You're right, Your Honor. In this scenario, the harm did not occur to the insured because Liberty Mutual acted objectively reasonably and Mid-Continent acted objectively unreasonably, and Liberty Mutual paid Mid-Continent's share so as to protect the insured.
Well, you know, I have a problem with that analogy coming from an insurance background. I mean, what's reasonable to one carrier, certainly not reasonable to another, not reasonable to a plaintiff, not reasonable to a defendant, not reasonable to a corporation. Reasonable men and minds differ.
I agree with you entirely, and I think that's why that the standard that was applied in this case and the standard that was applied in the general agent case is so important. The standard, I believe, is much higher than any other standard that's applied. It's higher than negligence. It's higher than the good duty of good faith and fair dealing. The standard that the court found in this case was that Liberty Mutual acted objectively reasonably and that Mid-Continent acted objectively unreasonably. That finding has not been challenged by Mid-Continent. I believe
finding based on evidence of what the case was worth, what the plaintiff's case was worth?
Yes, Your Honor. What that was based upon was the evidence that developed during the course of the defense of the case, where the parties changed their positions as to the valuation. And the trial court found that Mid-Continent unreasonably refused to change its valuation, relying upon Liberty Mutual to take care of settling its portion.
It looks like, generally, the plaintiff in that situation, are in a difficult position because you've been arguing in the liability suit that the plaintiff doesn't have a case, and now you've got to turn around and argue that their case was really pretty good and we were going to get stuck a lot worse than he thought. How does that work on the dynamic of the trial?
Well, in terms of the underlying case, obviously, had the underlying case been tried, then the defense would have been asserted as vigorously as possible against the plaintiff's claims. Since that case was not tried and we ended up with a settlement, then we had to, in essence, try the conduct of the two insurers in the underlying trial. And that's what we did in this case. We tried the conduct of the underlying insurers, and the trial court found that objectively, the conduct of Mid-Continent, based upon the facts, the totality of the circumstances known at the time, they acted unreasonably.
Was there evidence that you settled for higher than you should have because of the excess coverage?
No. I believe the evidence was that the facts changed, where it appeared as the course of the case went on and got closer to trial, the liability became clearer, the damages were always significant, and as those liability facts became clearer, the evidence deduced at the trial court level was that Mid-Continent made some internal adjustments to their authority level, saying, well, this case is worth more than we said, but when they came to mediation, they did not put that money on the table. Instead, they held back, relying upon Liberty Mutual, holding Liberty Mutual in essence hostage to make sure that Liberty Mutual would pay the full amount and get the case settled. And that was the basis for the trial court's finding of objectively unreasonable conduct.
Well, why didn't Liberty Mutual say, well, two can play this game, so no settlement?
They could have.
Does the fact that you have an excess policy to protect have any basis in your evaluation of the claim?
I don't believe that the excess policy has any place in this analysis, either at the trial court level or at our level that we're at here now. It was almost a happy coincidence in the sense that it gave a source of money to pay this loss.
Well, you say that, and you've said it twice now. My question is, was that based on a prediction of what this court would rule in this very case, whether there is that right to contribution or subrogation, whatever you want to call it?
I don't believe it was, and of course there's no evidence.
No, but I'm saying, you say that the money was available there from Mid-Continent, and it wouldn't have settled without that other insurance money that could have contributed to this claim, and you thought you would be able to get it back. Wasn't that just your analysis of what the law eventually would be?
I don't think that's, it could be, but I think in all fairness, I think that the real analysis here was, what is the value of this case? The value of this case and the settlement demand is being made, we need to meet. At $1.5 million, which is what the case settled for, that's a really good settlement because at trial we may end up with a $3 or $4 million verdict.
Well,
and so they paid.
And with a $3 or $4 million verdict, you're solidly into the excess. And so that you were, in a way, protecting your excess in agreeing to settle more. And how are courts to ferret out where those interests come into play to make a person's position reasonable or not reasonable?
Excellent question, and I think the way you look at that is you look at this setting. They each had primary limits of $1 million, both of these two carriers. And so if the case was worth settlement of $1.5 million, and in other words, we didn't get past $1 million for each, then each should have paid their $1 million. Had the case valuation gone above $2 million and it was worth and the settlement was $3 or $4 million, then obviously the excess carrier has to come in. But I submit that in this particular case, what we have to focus on is the two primary numbers, because that was what was supposed to be protecting the insurer, which is...
Well, but the insurer's protected, really. I mean, if you wouldn't mind walking me through the subrogation scenario, I have a little bit of a hard time seeing how that could ever work when the insured is fully protected because the case was settled.
Well, because... you're right, because the case is settled, therefore the insurer is not exposed because one insurance carrier has then paid more than their share. So you have to look at almost like a fiction. But equitable subrogation has always been looked upon as somewhat of a fiction. And what we have to consider here is if both insurance companies were unreasonable, then we wouldn't have a settlement and the insured could be harmed. If one insurance company is unreasonable, then does the insurer have a right of action? And in my contention is that they would. The only difference between general agents and the existing law in Texas is that this case was settled. If this case had gone to trial and there had been a verdict, and that verdict was $2 million, there is no question, and Mid-Continent has admitted this, that they pay their $1 million and we pay our $1 million. And that would be that. The only thing the general agents does is it tells us, what do we do if there's a settlement?
But that's the problem I'm having with the subrogation argument is the premise of the subrogation argument is that the insured has been injured in some way. And when you take away that underpinning, how do you apply the equitable subrogation construct here?
Because you're right, the insured has not in fact been injured because somebody else has stepped up and paid that owed by another. But that does not mean that the insured would not have that right. For example, insureds in this area, oftentimes, their rates are based on their experiences. In other words, their loss histories. So it could be that the insured's premiums are going to be higher because its carrier, Liberty Mutual, paid more than it should have, and Mid-Continent paid less. So there are circumstances where the insured can sustain direct injury. In this particular instance, you're right. The insured did not, in fact, sustain a direct injury. But that doesn't mean that we cannot analyze the case from the standpoint of what would have happened had he sustained such a direct injury. Does the insured have a cause of action against the insurance company? And it's always been this court's desire to protect the insured.
In this case, if the dispute had not settled and all the other facts are the same, would the insured have Stourized your client or the appellant's client?
He could have, and the only reason I hesitate to my answer is because the excess insurance makes a difference. So let's just pretend like there was $2 million in coverage and no excess. Then you probably would have had a stour situation. It's possible that there could have still been a stour situation because the injuries were severe.
Well, in this case, the settlement offer was $1.5 million, right? And each of the two parties here had $1 million in primary coverage. So certainly Mid-Continental wasn't stourized if the insured had presented that as a demand to Mid-Continental, because that's in excess of its policy limits. It's in excess of your client's primary policy limits. So if the case hadn't settled, do you believe the insured had stourized your client?
My client may have been stourized because of the presence and existence of the excess coverage, but Mid-Continental was not. I agree. That's why I don't think this is a stourage case. But I also think that the level of the standard here that is being applied, the totality of circumstances and objectively unreasonable, takes care of all that, because what you have is a very high factual standard that my client had to meet in order to obtain recovery, and that's what general agents established for us. And had this case not been settled, under existing Texas law, there's no question that what would have happened. Mid-Continent would have paid $750. We would have paid. Liberty Mutual would have paid $750. And that is the basis under which I think that general agents should be upheld, and we should, and this court should inform the Fifth Circuit of what the standard is, that there is a cause of action here, and it does arise out of equitable contribution that has always been present in this state, and that the standard of evidence required in a settlement is extremely high. It is objectively unreasonable. It's not the bad faith standard of they should have known that settlement was reasonable. It's certainly not the negligence standard of stowage. I think it is a much higher standard.
So
than
the
that.
Objectively reasonable is a matter of law? Question.
I think objectively unreasonable and objectively reasonable is a matter of fact finding, because you have to.
So what you're saying is that we're going to have these cases out there where we're going to ask a jury a question. Under all the totality of circumstances that you've just heard about now, was Mid-Continent's conduct objectively unreasonable?
Yes.
That's the question that you ask.
That would be the question that you'd ask.
So we'll ask 12 people who have no experience in the insurance industry and have never spent more than $20,000 in their lives deciding whether they would have settled this case for $1.5 million or $1.75 million. This is what the insurance industry wants.
Well, in some settings, that's right, but that's no different than asking 12 citizens whether an insurance company has acted in bad faith, because the bad faith standard, which I submit is a lower standard than what general agents as opposed to what my clients prove under these facts, is equally difficult for a lay person jury to figure out. So, and again, I do get back to the point where I don't think that this type of a claim is going to happen very much. It hasn't happened very much in the law. If we look at even Mid-Continent's brief, I think they say it's a tiny sliver of a claim.
Why is it important to the jurisprudence of Texas?
Excuse me, sir?
Why is it important to the jurisprudence of Texas that it doesn't happen that often?
Because even though it doesn't happen often, that doesn't mean that a wrongdoer, which Mid-Continent was clearly found to have been here, should be rewarded, or that a wrongdoer should be allowed to escape the consequences of their wrong just because it doesn't happen.
Your opposing counsel was about to say why we haven't seen amicus briefs in this case. Do you have an opinion as to why we haven't?
I think because it is a sliver of a claim. It's not going to happen very often. It takes a perfect storm for this kind of a circumstance to come up. Those are the only kind of explanations that I can find.
Is it really that rare?
It is, because it is rare where you're going to be able. Usually what's going to happen is Liberty is going to have $1 million and Mid-Continent is going to have $1 million, and the settlement demand is going to be $2.5 million. They can't get there. Or, in our case, $1 million and $1 million, and that's all there is, and Liberty doesn't have the $1.5 million to make up for the shortfall. So only in the setting where there's money available. Maybe the insurer has to step in. That could have well happened. Again, fiction, I realize, but that could have happened. where the insured steps in and says, I'm going to pay. Now, I want to say one quick thing about voluntary payment.
But I guess when we start getting into equitable contribution rights between insurers, I would think that there would be a lot of interest in this case.
Well, that's because I don't think it's contribution. I think it's subrogation. I think what you really have here is equitable subrogation, where we have stepped, where Liberty stepped into the shoes of the insurer and is seeking to enforce its rights. And that is consistent with Canal and Texas law for a long time. And liberal construction of equitable subrogation, I think, makes more sense than equitable contribution. The only thing I want to say about voluntary payment is that they throw a voluntary payment really as a defense to the contribution claim. I don't think contribution is the right way to go. I think subrogation, equitable subrogation, is the better way to go. But I would note that the voluntary payment claim, in our view, is gone. And why is that? It's because of the wrongful conduct of Mid-Continent. There is no question that in all of the bad faith decisions where one insurance company has committed bad faith, that they lose their contractual defenses. They have, in essence, breached, and that's what happened here. So we don't think that the voluntary payment provision would have made any difference. But again, the voluntary payment provision only applies if we're talking about an equitable contribution scheme.
Wait. Say that again. The voluntary payment is their contractual defense, because if we stick with straight subrogation, you step into your insured shoes, sue them, they claim voluntary payment, no legal liability, no judgment. How does voluntary payment only go to equitable contribution?
I see it correctly.
Okay. Now, it seems to me like the problem that you have two problems. On, we just stick with the same scheme that we have right now. You go against them, they defend on their contract, they've got a single limit policy, they may have paid some of it somewhere else. Everybody stands on their own contracts and their contractual limitations. If we go to equitable contribution, we just throw that out the window, it seems like, don't we?
No, because I think, and that's why I agree with your point on equitable subrogation, the voluntary payment does become a factor, because with the wrongful conduct, again, I get back to the finding, which I think is
okay.
Prevalent.
You either have to have wrongful,
that goes away.
You want to have wrongful conduct to defeat their voluntary payment defense, or you might prefer to have a definition of payment under this situation not being a voluntary payment. Either one of those gets you the same place. We don't have to restructure law. We just have to deal with a subrogation claim, and everybody writes their own contracts, sets their own premiums, and all we deal with is the insured rights under the contract that they bought or have.
That's right. I agree with that. I agree with all of that. And the insurer, in this setting, the insurance company stepped into the shoes of that insurer in this asserting.
And I wasn't preaching. I was asking, did I miss the scenario somehow?
I think you did it directly on the head, Your Honor.
Do you agree with the Fifth Circuit's factual amendment that Mid-Continental paid the Crabtree settlement after the Kinsel settlement so that its full $1 million was available?
Yes, sir, I did.
Okay, you
did. So stipulated at the Fifth Circuit level.
Both sides?
Yes, sir. Now, I guess since my time is about to run out, the only other point I'd make is it really is a public policy point. And I do think that if we let Mid-Continent get away with this kind of conduct, or any insurance carrier get away with this kind of conduct, that we are going to encourage harm to insureds and we are going to discourage settlements. There has to be a reasonable approach to the settlement by both of the insurers under this scenario.
I agree with that. It's exactly what you said. But how is this against public policy? How does it not, the current scheme, how does it not encourage parties to have dialogue and get these cases resolved if you have the risk of settling a case at your own peril?
Because if you don't have something to let one, in this setting, one insurance company enforce a right against the other insurance carrier, the Mid-Continent can hold an unreasonable position, an objectively verified and reasonable position, and they can hold that and not be responsible for that. And in my view, that is against public policy.
But it subjects itself to risk when they go to trial and lose. And they could have settled within the policy limits. Now you have an excess, a judgment in excess of the limits, and then there's stare decisis. There's a whole avenue for the insurer to pursue.
Right, but under If we don't give an insurance company in the position of Liberty Mutual, in this case, the general agent type rights, then that's where you're going to end up with. You're going to end up going all the way down that trail when indeed this trail could stop at an earlier point. And that's why I must emphasize it is the objective unreasonableness that is what drives our position in this case.
Mr. Capshaw, I'm just a little confused. Let me ask you, see if you can straighten me out here again. Your position is if we leave the current law as it is, you're entitled to equitable subrogation. You step into the insured's shoes. So all you want from you're saying under current law, your position is under current law, the finding of unreasonableness on their part allows you the equitable subrogation claim against them and that recovery. So you're really not wanting any change in the law.
That's right. I'm not. I'm wanting to be able to enforce the same equitable subrogation rights that I would have in a settlement that I can enforce in a judgment. In other words, if this case had gone to judgment.
Okay, so you want a settlement to be not a voluntary payment.
Yes, but I want that because that settlement was objectively reasonable to have been made. The objectively unreasonable conduct is what gets me. In other words, what I'm saying is...
Okay, but I thought you just said that that's the current status of the law. When you got that objectively unreasonable finding, that wiped out their contractual defense.
Under general maintenance, that's right. Okay.
And you did not pursue statutory contribution in Texas because there's no judgment?
Correct.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mr. Blakely, Mid-Continent is a wrongdoer and never challenged that finding. Its conduct was objectively unreasonable, and let's just assume all that is absolutely correct. And what part does that play in your analysis of whether there are subrogation, right, equitable subrogation or contribution or what have you?
Let me address that point, Your Honor. The finding was challenged at the Court of Appeals. It was not challenged as being clearly erroneous because that was not the proper standard of review, but it was challenged. And the problem that we have in this context is that the district court was, in making that finding that we were objectively unreasonable, was looking at one side of the equation. It was looking at only the allegations against Kinsell, and totally ignoring Mid-Continent's obligations towards Crabtree. We had two dogs in this fight. And if you want to look at how we acted with one insured in isolation.
I guess what I'm asking is, would your arguments change if the conduct of one insurer in this situation was clearly objectively unreasonable? That there was confession by the defendant, I did this and I caused those damages and you got coverage for it, the other side has coverage and you don't contribute. Would your analysis change if that were the case, if we didn't have any question about that it was objectively unreasonable? The question now is, you know, the extent to which Liberty can gain subrogation or contribution.
Obviously, I think you need some sort of finding of breach of duty based on unreasonableness or whatever that is. And if you don't have that, then you don't get anywhere under any theory.
Okay, so you have it, and what does that do to the general agent case?
It hasn't, but you still have to decide what theory you're going to proceed. Is it a subrogation action, or is it a contribution action? If it's a subrogation action, then let's just take the situation where you have an insured.
Let me just move it along a little bit further. Okay. Let's say that we decide it's not a subrogation action. What impact would that situation have on contribution action?
That would be an element that you would need to meet in a contribution action. You would also need to meet other elements. You would need to overrule employers versus transport insurance, say that the other insurance clause doesn't matter, take that out of the equation. You would have to overrule the voluntary payment portion of employers and say that doesn't matter. Then you would need to consider whether you actually have true co-insurers that are insuring the same risk. That is a prerequisite for contribution in every jurisdiction. You did not have that here. We did not have identical risks because we had different exposure in that case. The identity of risk is a key component in contribution in every jurisdiction that recognizes it. When you get through all those steps, then yes, you need some sort of finding with regard to breach of duty. What that standard would be is a tough concept. The court has wrestled with it at length in the first party context, and it's not going to be any easier in this context to come up with a standard that everybody thinks is correct. But obviously you do need some type of standard in there. And then finally you're going to need a measure of damages. And that's going to depend on the status of the insurers, whether they were actually primary insurers or whether there was a primary excess situation. Here you have both, and Liberty likes to jumble it all together and say it doesn't matter, but it really does matter. Because the primary carrier is never, or the excess carrier is never going to be entitled to contribution. They're going to be entitled to subrogation only under the best of circumstances. So you need to know who paid what under what policy. All of those factors need to come into play in any kind of contract.
If you have a situation, same scenario here, same parties involved, you got a different group of lawyers working in the excess carrier, an excess policy rather, they say, I think a reasonable sum is X, both of you go settle this case. Why would an excess carrier have any say-so in what the value of a case is if it's within the primary policy limits? It seems to me that if we expand this and you're creating a cause of action perhaps for an excess carrier and up the line through anybody that has a piece of the risk.
I think that's absolutely correct. You are creating and inviting litigation about litigation, and we will have more.
You said that at the time of the settlement, Mid-Continental was also considering the Crabtree issue. And I think that was ultimately a $300,000 settlement.
It was, yes, Your Honor.
Mid-Continental also knew that Liberty Mutual may have been Stourized by the demand in the Kinsale case, correct?
No, Stourers.
Or do you have a different position?
Stourers never really entered into it because there was at least, I believe, $12 to $13 million worth of coverage for Kinsale as opposed to one for Crabtree. There was a significant Stourers exposure on the Crabtree side. But on the Kinsale side, no argument has ever been made that there was ever a Stourers problem on that side.
Well, no actual problem. But if the settlement had fallen apart, was there a recognition that because the demand was $1.5 million, perhaps within Liberty Mutual's not just primary but excess coverage, assuming that meets the Stourers requirements, Mid-Continental knew that Liberty could have been Stourized or not?
Well, I think under current law, nobody was Stourized, and that presents some of the kinks in the Stourers doctrine because there was not a demand that was within anybody's limits so as to Stourize the primary carriers. The excess carrier was not Stourized because the primary carriers had not tendered.
So you disagree with the opposing counsel then on that point?
Well, I'm actually not so sure that he's really arguing that it was a Stourers situation, but if he is, I disagree with him.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and that concludes oral arguments for today. The marshal will adjourn the court.
All right.